listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host with the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have a very, very special guest, one of my favorite painters in the world, Mr. Justin Bua. How are you, Justin?
Good, sir. Thanks for having me on.
My first question, it's actually, you're the perfect social commentator to comment on this. You probably just watched the debates or you saw pieces of it. What was your reaction? I'm so curious because you have such a great view on the world and people. I just want to know your perspective just for the first couple minutes.
Truth be told, not really politically motivated in terms of like the candidates. I'm much more motivated about the topics, you know, about more just the art world and right. what I love so much. And I just feel like, in general, they're not really speaking to what's interesting to me, which is the degradation of society.
Right.
You know, there wasn't like real hard answers, but I want to know about, you know, what we're really going to do in a deeper, more profound way about what's been going on in the world. Right. And I think art is the greatest reflection of culture that we have historically. I mean, great art has always been a mirror of society.
Yes.
And it's a very different world now than it was, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And it's changing exponentially, and we're not preparing ourselves for the leaps and bounds that, you know, that we're making. I mean, I feel like politics hasn't really caught up to AI. Politics hasn't really caught on. I mean, certainly in my industry, it hasn't. That's kind of in general, I like to, you know, unless it's like, it doesn't mean I don't like political work. I love Francisco de Goya. I love, Delacroix's Liberty Leading the People. I mean, I love it when it really references the change, the real change that we need.
I love it. That's a great answer. You got my vote.
And you know what, quite honestly, I know it's a weird thing, but I'm running as a third party. So there you go.
That's awesome. Thank you. Well, you know, you've been making some really cool art for a long time.
You've
been having this really cool perspective on, you know, kind of like street art and hip hop and sports icons and jazz. We're kind of influenced by a lot of the same things, which I love, which is what made me gravitate towards your art. I had the Piano Man 2 up in my apartment for years and years and years. And my brother has the Jazz Trio, which I know many people have that piece. But let's go way back. You grew up in the Upper West Side of New York.
Yeah.
And then, like, what made you kind of like, what was it, a piece of art? Was it an artist? I know you, from your artwork, it seems like you're influenced by Dali and Picasso. But what was the piece of art? Or what was the moment of Zen for you that made you kind of want to direct your life in this path?
My grandfather was a letterer. He was a very hardworking and, you know, old school. It's like we talk about politics. Like, why are we not talking about the kids not wanting to work anymore? Why are we talking about everybody's cool with just getting a handout?
Right.
When my grandfather came up, he was in a factory working at 8 years old. Do I think it's a good thing? No, but he had what the kids today don't have, which is grit. And right. I think he taught me a lot of grit. He was a letterer. He did Felix the Cat. He did Bazooka Joe. He hustled on his own. He had his own comic that was a rival at one point to Mad Magazine until they put him out of business. He had Frantic Magazine. He was a good painter, not a great painter, a phenomenal letterer. So dope that when I would have my, you know, famous graffiti writer friends over, I would just be like, have my grandfather do some wild style or a burner or some 3D. And they'd be like, what? Like, they couldn't even believe it because it was better than any of us.
That's amazing.
Because he had the old school skill set, the right. shit that people don't do anymore. And so I think that's the real, that was what I got from him. And I learned a very hard working ethic that, that I just feel like is just lost. Is lost. Not for everybody, but for more so than I've ever seen in my life.
Right. Yeah, I think a lot of it is the digital age has changed a lot of that. It's like having all the information in your pockets versus having mm-hmm. we grew up in a generation where it's like, go look it up. You know what I mean? So you're gonna have to go to an encyclopedia and go thumb through it. Like, that's not really an option, and people just have everything in their fingertips. So I love that you said that, because I see that too, and I see it in younger artists and the next generation too. And it's I think every generation gets a little lazier than the next, and I think that every generation is trying to just, I guess, they're trying to do their best. But I totally agree. The grit thing is,
yeah, I don't think they're trying to do their best. I think we've created a, you know, I got three kids. I'm not talking out of not having the wisdom of raising three children. You know, I think that we've created a trophy generation of kids.
Totally.
Everything is, everybody deserves a trophy. Everything is nerf edged. Don't hit your head. Don't fall down. You did as good as him. We all know second place is first place for losers. Like, we're not, you know what I mean? Like, the grit, the real grit that other countries have,
right?
They talked a lot of the debate, but let's be real. Like, why is China so successful? Because they got grit. You know, why are immigrant families so successful? Because they have grit.
Yep.
You know, and I think that as a country, we've lost the grit. And because, like you said, like, kids are like, well, I deserve that. When I was a teacher, this is a really crazy story. When I was a teacher on my last day after 12 years at USC, and a lot of people joke, and I never liked it.
I went to school there, yes.
Okay, but you know what they say. The acronym is University of Spoiled Children. I don't like that because I taught there. You went there.
Yeah. Right?
Yep. But, like, a lot of people, when I went around, I said, what do you want to do when you graduate? And I kid you not, everybody said, I want to be a CEO. I want to be the president. I want to be a millionaire. I want to be a billionaire. I want to be the top dog. I want to be the leader. I want to be making money. I want to be famous. Nobody said I want to be a great artist.
Wow.
Now, I'm not saying I've had great artists come through the system.
Right.
Okay, I've trained great artists. I've watched kids who were diamonds in a coal mine. I mean, you know, just like, just incredible. Come from nothing and become something. But it's that attitude that softens you.
Yeah,
you can have that attitude and be successful, period.
It's entitlement. I say entitlement is like the most dangerous characteristic, because it just doesn't teach you survival of the fittest, doesn't teach you grit, doesn't teach you hustle. And I think that's everything to, like, you make, like the phrase that I was kind of taught was like, the harder you work, the luckier you get. And it's like,
that's right.
That's really how I think. And I love that you think the same way. And there's a lot of parallels, because you actually went to the College of Design in Pasadena. I grew up in Arcadia.
Okay.
So tell me what that experience was like for you. You're a young artist.
Yeah.
This, you know, you're crossing the country to the other side, and you go to a school full of artists. Did that help you kind of develop your style? Was it kind of stifling as an artist to try and figure out your own unique style when you were trying to learn other people's styles, you know?
Great question. And I went to high school. Well, first of all, let me backtrack. I went to High School Music Performing Arts in New York.
Awesome.
So I was that was a scholarship school, because the other options were like, you know, you're going to get your ass kicked at Martin Luther King High School, or, you know, Brandon. You want to be going to, like, Bronx Science, Brooklyn Tech, or LaGuardia, period. I got into LaGuardia, found out later I was like a bottom choice. I was like the very last choice. I got in, I went there, and when I got into the Art Center College of Design, I thought I was top dog. Because, you know, Art Center at that point was a little bit like a military academy.
Right.
It was rough. It was like, You're going to go through basic training. They're going to put you through the cycle. They're going to wash you. They're going to grind you. And it's, you know, it's not fun. And when I went, I thought I was the man. And the first day of class, I was drawing and I looked to my right and I saw this kid Victor's drawing. I looked to my left. I saw this kid John's drawing and I almost cried. I was like, wow. Because you know, I've never been unrealistic about where I am. If someone's better than me, I'm going to say, hey, you're better than me. You could draw better than me. I'm going to admit it. You know, color, composition, value, design, atmosphere better than me. I'm going to admit it. Everybody, with the exception of a couple people, were better than me in that room. We were in a portrait drawing class. And I felt shameful. And I went to the hallway and I said, this is insane. Like, I'm so out of my league. These people are so much better than me because I'm at the Harvard of art schools and I'm just below them. And then I walked back in the room. I saw one person that was on my level, maybe one person that was worse than me. And then like 80% that were better. And I was like, you know what? You're just going to have to grind. You're just going to have to get better, you know, because you're not as good as them. And here it's a hard pill to swallow. It's the kind of thing that kids today, they can't swallow that. Hey, you're not as good as them. What are you talking about? How dare you say that? That's bullying. And you know, the typical neo-Marxist, you know, thing where, you know, it's always the oppressor oppressing the oppressed, you know, like that's people's attitude. If I say something that I feel on Instagram, you see the post right now that's 12 million views, it's going wild. And there's a lot of crazy stuff that people are saying, but it comes from that is because I'm on the other side. Right. I'm not the best one. I am the worst one. And I got to swallow the reality of that. And right. So what did I do? It just made me grind harder. It just made me get better.
Yep.
It just made me go, okay, well, it's time. What are my weaknesses? I have so many weaknesses. What are they? You know, and then I started realizing what my weaknesses are and I had different levels and experiences. So on top of that, I'm in Pasadena. And so I'm a hard rock kid from New York City and I'm here with all these LA people saying hi to me, being friendly. And I'm like, are you trying to play me? Like, are you trying to hustle me? Like, cause where I'm from,
right.
You know, like that kind of attitude is going to be like, you're trying to rob me or like, so. Okay. Yeah, it was definitely a very different experience. It was my fish out of water experience. But I learned and I learned from not just my teachers. I had some profound teachers, but I learned from a lot of the students who were just better than me.
I feel like, you know, when I went to USC, I went to USC School of Music and I felt the same way. It was I learned more from the students, I think, than some of the faculty just because it was the students that are going to push you when you're not in school and you see them practicing or they're in the practice rooms for 6 hours. You're like, oh my God, I need to be doing that. So it's just like when you see somebody that's that good, it kind of like pushes you to kind of dig into what you can do. And what's ironic is you've made some of the most iconic portraits. So for you to be in that class and now looking at your work now, I mean, you've done some really unique and beautiful portraits of great artists. We're going to talk about some of them, but how did you kind of start developing what colors you want to use? Because like, I think you're kind of a genius when it comes to coloring, like the paints, the colors that you use. I mean, they almost look like textures in a painting that are three-dimensional because you do so much with them. And, you know, in a world where I studied opera and I studied all the, you know, great artists of that came before, and I'm sure you did too. How did you use those things to create a new voice for your work?
Well, thank you. I don't really have a lot of people telling me I'm great at color. I feel like I'm great at a lot of things. Color is one of those things that's like composition where you can never get too great. And you look at like the classical people that are known to be great are Vuillard, Bonnard. Those are both impressionists. I really like Degas. I mean, there's so many people who are great at color. Thank you for saying that I'm one of them. But I think that to me, color is mood. You know what I mean? Like the most important thing in a painting is shape. The second most important thing is value, which is dark to lights. And the third most important thing is color. So it doesn't even hit my radar. And like I could have the wrong color, the right shape, the right value, it'll look okay.
Right.
So you might be tricked a little bit because my value's on point that you're like, oh, Boo is good at color, but I might be just hitting you with the value and your mind is going, ooh, that's nice. And the better you are with value, it's like the same thing about drawing. The better you are at drawing, the better you are at painting. Most painters' mistakes is bad drawing.
Right.
Most painters' mistakes is bad drawing. There's some painters who are decent at painting, but they can't draw. And that's always unusual to me. And there's and because of that, there's a weakness. There's always a kind of a weakness. And I think that for me with color, I've always been muted for most of my life because I was influenced by a lot of the Dutch masters, like Rembrandt was a very, very dark palette. Beautiful colors, but dark as hell.
Right.
You know, Hans Holbein. Bruegel the Elder. So I feel like these colors mixed with maybe my New York City color palette, which can be very dismally gray, but there's nice things about that, right? There's a warm gray.
There's contrast.
There's a blue gray.
Yes.
There's a cool gray. So like playing with the nuances, I guess like music with tone. Just these little changes of tone in color can make a painting stand out. And if I could create a color that's tethered to the emotion of the portrait, that's high level painting. And that's what I try to do. I try to, anytime I'm painting a portrait, I try to get the spirit and then echo it third with the color. First, it's shape, spirit, value, and color.
Well, let's, you know what? Let's show a piece real quick. I want to show the first two pieces that I first laid my eyes on that made me gravitate to everything that you did and have done. Let's start with Jazz Trio. Let's pull this up. Sam, let's pull up Jazz Trio if you can.
Yeah, Jazz Trio's super old school. 96, man. I was so young.
What a great image. I mean, like, this was one of the first things I ever saw, and nobody was really painting stuff like this. What I love, it's like you have the kind of like the influences of Dali where you're bending shapes and size and contortions and depths, but you have the colors that he would put in his paintings. Dali's my favorite painter. Mm-hmm. Besides somebody like yourself, you are my favorite contemporary. And it's like you both use color to create the characters. It's like all of your characters come to life because of the colors that you use, even just the stark contrast between each player in this piece. And like, I'm a musician, so like, you know, you see this pianist playing and you know, you see in purple, then you have the trumpet player in green and you got the bass player. I mean, everybody has this unique part of their character to make it what it is. And it's like the swirls of whatever, the curtains or whatever, the back lights. Tell me what inspired this. I've been dying to ask.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because it's such an old painting that to me, I'm like, whoa, I was so young when I did that. This was much more of an emotional piece, but it's predicated on the S curve. And it's a very classical compositional trait where you could see the S curve from the piano player, you know, coming up to the trumpet and to the bass. And so it's an S. And then you have a counter C curve, right? You have that C curve coming down, and those are the curtains. Everything is ensconced in, washed in red light, I guess. The direct light is a hot, warm light coming across the keys. And everything is kind of what I did back then in the early, early Bua days, was everything was like gradating warm to cool. You know, like so exaggerated that it was like the keyboard is so hot and then we go to cool, which is jazz, right? Like that's, it's hot, it's cool, it's red, it's blue. It makes me think of Monk, Coltrane, you know, and the jazz clubs that I, you know, frequented when I was a kid, going to some of the clubs downtown and even uptown in Harlem, really experiencing it firsthand. Not only just hip hop, but really jazz. And so, you know, now I would handle the painting in a completely different way, but the early pieces I'm not able to reproduce anymore because they're vibe pieces.
Right.
Like this is not a technical anything, you know, it's stiff. It's the colors are simple, like, you know, but the vibe is just so, you know, when people think of Bua, like when they think of me, they think of like this. Like that's quintessential Bua, because people can just, it's like a feeling, it's a vibe.
And I'm going to tell you this. So I went to school studying classical music, but all my roommates were jazz musicians. And what was so amazing is that's when I started discovering your art, like when I was in college. And what was so amazing about it was you made jazz so cool.
Mm-hmm.
Two jazz artists were showing me your art. And they're like, look what this guy's doing. He's like, he's capturing jazz in a way that makes it cool again. Because in some era, like, you know, jazz in the 50s and 60s was the pop music of the time. And it's like in the 90s and the 2000s, it became like almost like the background, you know, the background music. And you gave it this voice of like the essence of cool again. And that's like, I'm going to tell you, a lot of jazz musicians who are listening would agree with me that you made jazz musicians cool with this. And I want to pull up another one. Let's pull up Piano Man 2, because this was the one that, well, I remember looking through a music store. And when I saw this, this was hanging up in my apartment for a long, long, long time. When I saw this, I got to compliment you on the piano. The piano, a lot of painters don't get the instruments right. They don't get the details. They don't get the ivories. Like they don't get all the, you know, kind of like the tones of the colors right. And what makes this really sing to me is the piano looks almost like exactly real. And then you have the caricature of the person. Tell me, like, what inspiration, or what was your inspiration behind this piece?
I had done Piano Man 1, which is a gentleman that looks a lot like Thelonious Monk in a yellow jacket.
Yeah, we've got that one. Okay.
And in 2001, I think I painted this one. And believe it or not, I painted it in one night, in one sitting. It was a 4-foot by 3-foot canvas. I painted it in acrylics. I really was into making all my acrylics feel like oil paints. So that was a whole other technical thing that I don't know was relevant or not. And once again, colors. Muted palette with a little pop, much like a James McNeil Whistler, or, you know, one of the Hokusai or Hiroshige, the Japanese wonderful printmakers. These are the ways that I'm trying to display just the notes of jazz, the notes of cool. And I think one of the things about this piece, too, that a lot of people feel is that, you know, he's handsome. Like, he's a guy, like, every guy goes, oh, yeah, I look like Piano Man, too. And every girl's like, he's hot. So, you know, but, like, I think that was an important thing for me to get is, like, how can I project coolness, because that was my whole vibe in New York. Like, you want to be cool. You want to be down. You want to be cool. And it's kind of like that guy over there, he's cool. And so I would take these archetypes and project them onto the canvas. And one of the prerequisites is that they had to look cool. They had to look fly and they had to be clean. Look at the nails.
Right.
The nails are clean.
Yep.
You know, he doesn't. He's got no dirt under his nails. His cuticles are beautiful. You know, he's got the ivory nails and he's playing on the ivories. You know what I'm saying? So everything about him is just slick.
What's really cool too is the jacket. Like it kind of is like a nod to Picasso a little bit because of the shapes of his sleeves and stuff. Was that just like, oh, not intentional, intentional? Like, I see a lot of kind of like Picasso's cubism in just his outfit, how you orchestrated the shapes of his sleeves. Tell me what that was all about.
Yeah, you know, I think that one is about like the subway car graffiti. Like, how everything has a heavy, bold outline. That goes back to my grandfather with his lettering. Everything is fresh shape. It's all shape.
Right.
And if you take the shape and you outline it, that's cartoony, right?
Right.
So in cartoons, if you have a heavier line, you have a more of a cartoon line. Like Hanna-Barbera, very heavy.
Yep.
Then, you know, then you go to Disney, it gets thinner, right? CGI, the realism doesn't exist anymore. You know, Island of Dogs, Wes Anderson doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
So I like the cartoon element because it reminds me of graffiti.
Yeah.
And then the flavor is just very geometric, like popping.
Yeah.
You know, there's this like King Tut. You know, there's the wave and then there's the actual, you know, stylization of the cultural importance of shape. Once again, in movement, everything has to move. I'm very big into gesture and I'm very big into movement. And so the graffiti was influencing me and also breakdancing because I was a professional B-boy for many, many years. And that was very, that's the difference with me and most artists is that I could actually dance. You know what I'm saying? And like that dance is in my work.
Yeah, you can see it. And I was going to say, one of the things that's cool is that because you love breakdancing and the music also, it's influenced in your work. It's like a voice in your work. And you'll appreciate this. So you know the movie Breakin'.
Yeah. Know.
So Turbo, Michael Chambers, I'm friends with him, and I asked him to be in my music video. So during one of the piano solos, he asked.
You're talking about Boogaloo Shrimp.
Boogaloo Shrimp, yeah, exactly.
I battled him at the Funhouse 1984.
What? Really?
He roasted me.
Oh, well, he's
he, you know, when he was at his prime, he was amazing.
Yes, I agree.
He roasted me.
He was like such an influence on me because he was in the Lionel Richie music video. He was in Breakin' 1 and 2. One of the things I learned is he taught Michael Jackson how to pop and lock. I don't know
if he's one of them.
Yeah. So he was in my music video, and I was like, as soon as I read about how breakdancing is a huge influence, I'm like, man, I got so many parallels with this guy. He just loves all the same things that
I was in. I was in Beat Street.
Right, right.
As an extra, but I was in it.
That's crazy. That's so crazy. I want to pull up Piano Man 1.
Oh,
because I want
to talk, throwback.
Because yeah. the coloring. This is a perfect example of the coloring. Mm-hmm. You use this yellow at like such an incredible voice. Tell me, like, what was the inspiration with this? Because I love that it's early. We're going to show a bunch of the later works, too. Mm. But I love this because you see there's youthful excitement about the music and the design of this piece. Tell me a little bit about it.
You know, this is really the first piece that kind of – I did that one in 1994.
Wow.
Or, 93, 94. That is so old. I was very young. I did that once again in one night. It was 4 feet by 4 feet. And I was doing three shows for my boy, Andy Howe, the skater, who was one of the original artists and one of the owners of New Deal Skateboards. And I was doing it for a trade show. And I busted out three paintings. This was one of my paintings that I did in one night.
Wow.
I was high out of my mind. And I busted it out. And ironically, it has legs into the marketability of my work later on because Christina Ricci came to my house and she wound up buying the original painting.
Wow.
So, yeah, so I don't know where the painting is. She won't tell me. But anyway, this piece has such history to me because this was the first time that I was like, okay, I was doing my stylistic work in my sketchbooks, but I wasn't able to make it live onto canvas. Because I didn't have the technical virtuosity that I later achieved, which kind of somehow maybe changed the Buaness of my work. But this was very Bua, very much what was happening in my sketchbooks. And then all of a sudden, it appeared on a canvas. And I was like, that's it. This is me. This is me. This is what I'm doing. And so that's why this was like the beginning of all my style.
It's awesome. And it's actually one of the first pieces I ever saw as well. I kind of wanted to start, showing some of your early pieces because that's what got me so interested in your work. I mean, what's so fascinating about me getting the chance to interview you too, like a lot of the painters that I love, they're not around anymore. And it's like, it's so amazing to be able to ask you these questions about these pieces. Like even the fact that you did these pieces in one night, most people don't know that. And that's remarkable in and of itself. I want to pull up 1981 Breakdancing. So talked about breakdancing. This is one of the most visually spectacular pieces. I just love everything about it, from the shape of the buildings. It's like you make it animated with how he's moving, with the shape of the buildings, with the people. I mean, this is like a moving picture. Tell me what the inspiration behind this was.
Well, I'm born and raised on 98th and Broadway, and Rocksteady Park is on Amsterdam, 100 Street. So I'm growing up next to amazing dancers like Crazy Legs, and Ken Swift was a block away from me. Doze Green, my friend Doze, great friend of mine. original Rocksteady crew, the famous graffiti artist. He was a block away from me. So all of these nascent moments of the culture were happening in my neighborhood. So I bore witness to these early moments. And I would go to Rocksteady Park. I would dance at the Douglas Projects. I would dance at some of the projects. I would battle these kids. I would go to the Roxy. Like I said, I was in Beach Street because I was there at the right place in the right time.
Right.
But this was a reenactment of the moment where the backspin became the windmill. So it was called the continuous backspin. And that moment where it kind of took flight, I think it's credited to Crazy Legs. People can argue about it, but this was that era when things started to fly. Now it's just off the charts. You know, now it's just like, I don't even know how people are doing like 14 elbow tracks to head spins to, you know,
right.
It's just like, forget it, right? Because we were much more style centric. And then it also is, you know, part of the culture. People are wearing their Kangos, their Cazelles, they're dressed up in the regalia of the movement, the Adidas shoes, the gold chains, the belt buckles, you know, my boy right there with the white Kango on the B-boy's right foot, you know, the foot on the left side of the screen, you could see the Puerto Rican flag on his belt buckle, the boombox in the background, people looking out the windows, birds, pigeons flying. I mean, these were those moments where we weren't distracted by the phone.
Right, right.
We weren't on like, oh yeah, that's cool, but yo, you should check this out, right? Like, I'm going to send this guy that, like that. So now we're lost. And I feel like we were more collectively connected. If you could see here, there's a black girl, there's a Puerto Rican dude, there's a white guy, there's an Asian girl. We came from downtown, uptown, Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, Staten Island, New Jersey. Everybody came together because we all love dancing. We all love community. And we're very separate now.
Right.
So we're in a different spatial mindset. And so this is the celebration of culture.
Well, what's really great that you capture too, it's, you know, you can bring all these people together if there's a commonality, and that comes through love of something.
Maybe
like the dancing, you know, all of that, that's still here. And that's what's refreshing about like what artists have to do now. It's like, we have to kind of create those moments for people to create environments like this, because media is kind of like making us, you know, separate. I want to go move to another picture. So you started doing some amazing portraits of real people, real artists. Let's pull up Prince. Let's pull up any of the Prince pictures, paintings.
Yeah.
This is one of my favorites, Prince the artist. So I love that you have the third eye sunglasses, like really like captured who he was and his spirit in this picture. Tell me how much of an influence he was on you, because he's a huge influence on me.
First of all, Prince is a virtuoso. Let's start there.
Yeah.
Secondly, I mean, I hung out with Ronnie Wood from the Stones.
Yeah.
We went to see him at Nokia. He was doing a small show. So I was sitting in the pit with Ronnie, and an intermission, I was hanging out with him. And I was like, yo, because, you know, Ronnie's a painter, too. I don't know if you know that.
Oh, I didn't know that. No.
Yeah. So I said, yo, like, how good is he? Because you hear, like, he's good. Like, I know he's good. Like, he's flavorful. But how technically good is he? You know what I mean? He's like how he talks, right? So he's like, I'll start telling you, like, I asked Eric Clapton the same thing. You know what I mean? He's like, I said, who's the greatest guitar player of all time? And he says to me, looks me in the eye and says, it's Prince. And I was like, Eric, wait, I want to rewind that, bro. Are you telling me, Ron Wood of the Rolling Stones, are you telling me that you asked Eric Clapton who the best guitar player was that you knew that was alive today, and Eric Clapton told you it was Prince? And he said, that's right. And I was like, God damn, man. like the singing was ridiculous. The dancing was nuts.
Yes.
The charisma was crazy. The dude was on bass. He was playing piano.
Yep.
He was playing guitar. He was playing drums. Nuts. That's how he was. Now, spiritually, he was a man of wisdom.
Yes.
He was not into pharmaceuticals. He was, you know, he's not into medication. He was very, very God-centered, right?
Yep.
Jehovah's
yep.
Witness. He was just on, he knew what was going on. And we're not just talking about the co-option and the medicalization of humanity by big conglomerates. We're also talking about something which is very deep with respect to the way that he felt enslaved by the masters of the business.
Yes.
So he was teaching a lot. He was a teacher. I think ultimately, to be honest, you know, who knows, right? Like, who knows really what, but I think he was a very dangerous opposition to freedom on so many levels.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, to not only to the medicalization of humanity, but to the enslavement of the record industry, to the individual. And really that goes into so many areas, right? He knew so much. He had so much wisdom to share. He was very smart. Like, if you just go on a Prince tangent, eventually you go on some weird random talk show and you're like, this dude is like, I didn't even know anything about that.
Right.
And then I started listening to his mind and how he was thinking. And I was like, oh, he's a problem.
Right.
Not only is he just the best musician in the world and he gets all the hottest girls and blah, 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 but he is a problem because he knows how the mechanics of the non-democracy or the fake democracy works. He understands that. And he's talking about it. That was the most freaky thing about it. I was like, oh, damn, Prince is saying some crazy stuff. I started going down the rabbit hole. I was like, he's not wrong either. Like that. So it was like a little,
yep.
It was like a little like, oh, okay. But back to the musicianship, it's like, man, if I could be, I'm not that good as a painter. Like I really wish to tell you that.
You are.
No, but I'm not. Like the Prince, the tribute to George Harrison joint, when he goes solo,
yep.
And you just see Tom Petty and everybody are like, oh, this dude here, like they just had to kick back and be like, he was a show off, but rightfully so.
Well, and also he was taking the guitar solo, and then he had one of his security guards like push him back up on stage. I mean, just those things were so orchestrated.
The fact that he would kick the stand, do two turns. I was a dancer.
Right, right.
He was singing, playing, and dancing at the same time with ease and
right.
grace. And yep. he was like 3'11", bro.
I know.
I mean, like it wasn't really, but he was really small.
Well, and the other thing, too, I met him once, and he was small, and then he would wear heels. He wore heels that looked like they were straight out of a Disney movie. I was just like, how is
it? And it didn't look bad on him.
No, it
looked great.
He worked them, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know this, but he's the reason. So they were going to destroy the Forum. They were going to tear it down.
Mm.
That's the reason he did the 22 concerts at the Forum.
And interesting.
He's the reason that the Forum did not get torn down because he said, I saw Michael Jackson here. I saw the Los Angeles Lakers play here. Like, this place has a spirit and an energy that you can't destroy.
Yeah.
And so he is the reason it's still a working venue. And it's all because of him. So it's like he knew his power. And I love that you documented that in your I want to pull up the Purple Rain picture of Prince. Like, this is such a clever and beautiful portrait of Prince, and it's like I gotta talk about the water real quick. The water looks so real, it's ridiculous. How did you create that effect?
Well, water is, you know, it's, this is shtick. Like, this is not painting, this is shtick. It's like you paint the background first and you paint basically a circle and or a sphere, and you think about light travels through the sphere, right? So on the lighter side, like on the where it's violet behind them, you're going to have the corner of that sphere, right? And it's going to get hit with light and it's going to gradate darker. And oftentimes with the sphere, it comes through to the other side, right? It goes in one side, it has to go out the other, like an eye. When you paint an eye, you have the highlight And then if you have brown eyes, you have that orange spot, right? These are just like things you learn that's like painting, I wouldn't say 101, but the basics. And so you do it enough, you could just paint water like that. You do it enough, you could just paint eyes like that.
Right.
But it was, I wanted it to be very realistic, contrasted to how stylized the head was. I had done very realistic heads of prints, and this was just kind of so, you know, almost out of my head. Like oftentimes I don't like to look at reference.
Right.
Because it disturbs me. It's like, oh, now I'm copying a photo. I'm that guy. I don't want to be that guy.
Right.
I want to be a guy who just kind of creates a prince that we've never seen before. So that's kind of how I, and then the, you know, the emblem of Prince is like when that moment where I didn't really like that, when he's like, I'm going to be a sign. I understood the purpose of it, but it was like, come on, you're Prince.
Right.
It's like the best name ever. Like you, now you're a sign. But the name is just so perfect. I really like when it came back to the name.
Yeah, and you capture his essence in all of the paintings that you have of him. I want to pull up the Sade painting that you did because it's also one of my favorites.
This is more recent, yeah.
I mean, it is seriously a beautiful portrait of any woman, but you really encapsulate Sade in this. Tell me what.
Yeah, I wish you could see the original because it's so painterly and it's so beautiful. Like I have the original here. I didn't sell that one. But yeah, you know, like Sade is another person that we grew up with. It's unfortunately a lot of the kids don't even know who she is.
She's like one of the greatest ever. Yes.
She's one of the greatest ever, and she was so beautiful, and her music was so captivating, and it spoke to a generation of peace and tranquility. And this is a bit of a amalgamation of Art Deco. So we're talking about artists that I love so much, like Alfonso Mucha and just, you know, Erte. And this was very, I feel like she spoke to the world, emanating floral energy and light. And at the same time, she's like in the heavens and space, right?
Right.
There's something ethereal about her. And she's that, you know, that's a very famous photo. And I had tried, I always try with portraits, like how many times could I do it before I kind of hit the nail on the head? And I went right back to the photo.
Wow.
Because it's so classic. It's like Tupac with the bandana, just, you know, Biggie with the hat. It is so her that you can't separate it. So I went back to that. I added a lot of stuff around it and a different color palette. And like I said, we're seeing it on the screen, but that is actually, because it's a pretty recent piece, it's 2022.
It looks super vibrant. Especially
But if I showed you the original, you would lose your mind.
Wow.
Because the oil paint is so thick and juicy. You see, now I'm painting in oils, and oils is much more sensual. And it's like, when you see this painting in its original, you're going to lose your mind.
I'd love to see it. When we hang it, yeah, absolutely. Well, what's also so great, too, it's like the contrast of the lighting on her face. And then all of that energy that you put around her. It's like the central focus. And you can't help but just stare right into the heart of the painting right there. You know, it's just... it's really, really beautiful and just
thank you, bro.
Unbelievable.
Thank you so much.
I want to move to some hip hop because we got to pull up the Run DMC picture because the Run DMC picture is seriously one of the coolest just because of the way you kind of have them all positioned.
Yeah.
And Run DMC, they're so old school and they're like one of the icons of hip hop. So we're going to pull up the, here it is. Tell me, I love that you have the Adidas front and center. I mean, the track suits. With the logo, tell me what the inspiration of capturing all that. And, you know, it's just perfect. It's like the gold and everything. It's just.
Well, let's be honest. The Run DMC logo is we've seen it everywhere. You know, Run MMA, Run whatever. It's just ad nauseum. People have stolen the red, white, and black Run something. They've stolen it over and over because it's iconic.
Right.
I picture Run DMC, Daryl McDaniels, Run, Jam Master Jay, as one unit, because together they were the greatest.
Yes.
And actually they're probably the greatest of all time. People forget how influential they are. They were the first MTV hit. They were the first to go platinum. They were the first to be on Rolling Stone magazine. They were the first to have a brand endorsement deal. They were the first to sell out major stadiums.
Yep, and they combined rock and roll. I mean, nobody was doing
that. They were, the first to do a crossover with Aerosmith.
Yep.
I made a documentary that I directed on Run DMC, actually called Walk This Way, which is really freaking cool, where I was interviewing Daryl and Melly Mel and Kaz and MC Light and Ice-T. So, yeah, but that's how I saw it. And then the original is owned by Russell Peters, the comedian.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, it's like one of the iconic paintings. I mean, it's just so cool because it's so bold, so simple, but it's like I think a lot of the things that you do to encapsulate the people is what makes it so great, you know? It's really powerful. It's really...
You know, it's funny. I was going over... I'm going through my sketchbooks because we're archiving all my work. Like, if you see what's happening over there, you see all those flat files?
Yeah.
All my work.
Amazing.
I built this location to house all my work. And so I have people that work for me, and we're all archiving my work. And today we're breaking open my sketchbooks. We found all these Run DMC drawings I haven't seen in years. I'm doing a collector's edition of Legends of Hip Hop.
Wow.
So the first edition, I had like 50. In this edition, I have new artists like Lil Peep, Jazzy Jeff, Fresh Prince, Cypress Hill. A lot of the people that I never showed in my first book that I never painted. A new Eminem, a new LL Cool J, so many new artists. And I'm finding all this preliminary work of all these people like Run DMC, Beastie Boys, Tribe Called Quest that I'm putting in my new book. And we're scanning it at the highest resolution possible, like 800 DPI. No one is doing that because, you know, they don't even know where their work is.
Right.
So thank God I've kept my work contained. And yeah, it's been wild, but it's interesting that you showed the Run DMC, because today I was like, oh my God, I found all these drawings about Run DMC that I never knew existed.
Well, I want to pull up the Tribe Called Quest. Let's pull up Tribe Called Quest. This is like one of the baddest of the bad too. And it's one of my favorite hip hop groups as well. It's like, man, it's like some of the best. You really kind of captured these hip hop artists in such a beautiful way. I mean, you got the Midnight Marauders, you know, whole vibe with their outfits. And just the light, how they're all connected. Tell me what the inspiration was about this.
You know, I equate Tribe to the Beatles, and I know that's a little, it's reaching, but like in terms of...
Absolutely.
You know, Q-Tip and his producerial ways. Ali, Shaheem Muhammad with his jazz.
Yep.
You know, Fife with his... I've done stuff, really cool stuff with those guys. I just hung out with Jarobi in Miami.
Amazing.
These people are iconic, obviously. Fife, RIP. We did a concert together where I did a live painting and he sang. He did all the Tribe classics.
Wow.
You know, they were like the Beatles because they had so many classic pieces that we all know and love.
Yeah.
Works that have entered our consciousness, like the Beatles, like whether we know that that's the Beatles or not, we love it. And I would say the same with Tribe. I mean, I think the Beatles are, it's a little difficult because they were so exploratory,
right?
And they kind of, in my opinion, never did anything bad at all. You know what I mean? Like they were just so brilliant. But I think Tribe in terms of hip hop is close. I think they're the greatest, exploratory hip hop group that I've ever known.
Yeah, but I
was the combo.
Yep. And they had like an era where it was like really bringing it into the mainstream, which, you know, it's because of them that hip hop is the voice it is today. You know, it's like that. Let's pull up the Beatles. You did a Beatles one that I think
is cool.
Let's pull up the Beatles since we're talking about the Beatles right now. Tell me, I love that you put the images on their tie. I had to ask you about the inspiration behind, like, what made you choose, who got what tie, and how did you kind of come up with that?
Well, you know, you would think that Ringo would get Yellow Submarine, right?
Right.
But I didn't want to do that. I kind of wanted to flip it all around. It wasn't like this tie relates to this guy. I just wanted, you know, something that I love about the Beatles, for example, whether it's Abbey Road or White Album or Yellow Submarine or Revolver, I mean, Rubber Soul, they're the best. You know what I mean? And
I totally agree.
And they lived in an era where you had almost the best graphics represent the best of the Beatles. Like, I think I was looking at Let It Be the other day, and I was like, oh my God, the gorillas robbed them. And then Star Wars robbed the gorillas. Right. So it's like you have this, you know, post-modernist everything where it's like you can't help but to reference something else that's pop cultural.
Right.
And the Beatles started that because they were so pop cultural. And everything they did was iconic. It's not just their music or the introduction and exploration with Ravi Shankar and with, you know, and George Harrison or LSD and mushrooms. I mean, man, they were George Martin. I mean, they were so influential musically, but they were also like influential with their images. I mean, like, who was doing Yellow Submarine as an animation?
Yep.
That alone was just,
and it was iconic. It was iconic the way it looked. It was iconic with all of that. Mm-hmm. I want to pull up one of your famous pieces. Let's pull up DJ. This is like one of your, and we just saw it in your office. This is like one of your most iconic pieces. I mean, everybody knows this piece. Did you kind of like intend, did you think it was going to be what it was when you did it? Or was it just kind of like, did it surprise you? Because I think with all artists, there's always something that you create that surprises you with how successful, how much reach it has. Was this that piece for you? Or did you kind of think, I think this is going to like resonate with people?
Well, my distributor was really into my jazz pieces at the time. He was robbing me. He was making me famous, but I wasn't getting the money that he had promised me. So I said to him, I really need to, it's 2000. It's crazy. It's 24 years ago. I said, I want to do a piece that is reflective of my hip hop world. And I want to paint the DJ. And he was like, no one's going to put a DJ on their wall. So I did a sketch. He showed the sketch around. All the people that carried my work in downtown New York were like, oh, no one's going to put this on their wall. That's crazy. You know, people want jazz. People want Marilyn Monroe with the skirt coming up. You know, Al Pacino, Scarface. These are like, you know, Beatles, John Lennon, Strawberry Fields, whatever. Elvis, these are the iconic posters. And I was doing posters at the time, and I was very successful. And I was able to leverage a verbal deal, where I said, if I'm able to have success with my next jazz painting, I don't remember which one it was, maybe Jazz Quintet, will you allow me to paint my DJ? He said, sure. So I did pretty well. And he said, okay, you can paint the DJ. So I spent a lot of time painting the DJ because I wanted to. This was my one shot. Had an audience out there. This is pre-internet, right, really?
Right.
So, like, I had an audience, and I had a vast amount of people that were carrying my work in the mom-and-pop shops, the rock and roll shops, the head shops, the college market. And I did it. And when I did it, he took it around, and he tried to sell it. And none of the vendors wanted it.
Crazy.
They were like, oh, we don't want to touch that, Bruce. It's painted well, but the subject matter is irreverent. It's subversive. It's just, no one wants to do. Who's DJing?
Right.
Can you imagine that, right? Like, who's ever, now everyone's like a DJ, right? You could be like DJ/doula, DJ/barber, DJ/whatever. Every celebrity is a DJ, right? Every reality star. So, but at one point, it was not really cool to be a DJ. So no one picked it up. And for about a year, I painted and finished it in 2001. About a year, it just sat there and it didn't move. And I was like, wow, I failed. He was right. Bruce, my distributor, was actually right. I couldn't believe it because I was like, this is the greatest painting I've ever done. Once again, you see the original. It's crazy. These colors are weird. So he handed it off to a company in Canada called Imaginus. They were a college market door-to-door company that would sell prints in college vans. They would go to one school, then drive to another school, then drive to another school. My print started to sell really well there. Wow. And all of a sudden in Canada, they started to blow up. And he's like, oh, we have to produce more DJs. People in Canada are buying them like hotcakes. It was like, it went from like selling 100 to selling 1,000 to selling 10,000.
Wow.
And by the time everyone's like, well, what's hot? And they're like, well, this DJ image is hot. And everybody who didn't want my work is like, oh, well, we want that work. Next thing you know, I sold 16 million copies of the DJ.
Wow. Wow.
You know, and by the way, it's been in, you know, feature films like Entourage, Slum Village Video. I mean, you know, you name it, you know, on shoes, on t-shirts, I don't know, Hot Topic, this, that, the other thing. Like, everybody loved the image, and it became a classic, iconic image for a generation. I think this is the most sold painting of our time.
Yeah, that's what I read. I read that somewhere. That
and by the way, if you notice in the background, I'm shamelessly exploiting my other painting, Rising, which is what the DJ would have in the background in his world, right? So the DJ, the other thing about this painting is that I feel like I love to show artists in their element. You know, the DJ is spinning. He's not in front of an audience. It's like he's not a trophy kid. He's an 80s kid. Like he's by himself in a basement.
Yeah.
He's got an endless supply of
vinyls.
He's got a Wiggles VHS tape that he watches. He's got graffiti that his boy did on the wall. He's got one light bulb.
Yeah, right.
Very classic, by the way, because a lot of the masters used to paint one light source, not ambient light, not a reflected light source, not another light source, one tungsten warm bulb. Yeah, sure, there's a little light illuminating the DJ turntables, tiny. It's not affecting the atmosphere.
Right.
It's not affecting the color and value of where
you're getting the vibe of the room. You know what I mean with that?
And that's all you need.
Yeah, right.
And so this image, and by the way, this is also, you know, my statue that I had of the DJ sold out right away. This is, yeah, this image is ubiquitous. And people have copied it for generations now. It's weird to say generations.
Your instincts were right. You know, it's like, that's what you have to trust. As an artist, it's like, you can't listen to anybody. You can't listen to anybody in the industry. You have to listen to your heart and make what you want to make. I want to do a quick segment of sports icons. I want to pull up the Michael Jordan first. Let's pull up the Michael Jordan. This is a super iconic image with the shoes, with him flying through the air. It's just one of the most baddest images. And you captured it. So tell me, what was the inspiration behind it? What made you want to paint Michael Jordan? It totally like a pivot from what you did with all the music stuff.
Well, Michael Jordan's my favorite athlete of all time. And by the way, that's about a 1 hour painting. So that was never even designed to be anything but a quick sketch. So
wow.
Just to let you know, I did that whole painting in an hour. It's designed to be a much deeper, bigger painting, but I never kind of got to it. But yeah, you know, Michael's, once again, greatness.
Yep.
You know, I was watching Michael Jordan highlights the other day. You know what struck me weird?
What?
I've never seen anybody do this. And this was the craziest thing I've ever seen. Every play, this is true. Every play, it felt like he was going to die if he didn't get it done. I've never seen LeBron do that. I've never seen Kobe. Kobe's great. LeBron's great. Charles Barkley's great. Magic's great. But nobody was like, every single play, they were going to do it to the fullest capacity or they would die.
Yep, yep.
And that's how I feel about painting. If it's not, like, which is ironic because I only spent 20 minutes on this or an hour on this. But I feel like great painting is the same way. Like, you got to kill it. Like, I killed the DJ. I slaughtered it. It's got to be done, like done. That was what struck me weird about Michael Jordan as I was watching highlights the other day. I couldn't believe how every play, I was watching with my friend who was a big baller, and we were just like, Jesus, he tried, like, everything is like, I'm going to do this, or I'm willing to die.
Right.
I don't care. He's playing the Pistons. I don't care if, you know, Rodman hits me and John Sally smashes me and I'm nobody, going to die in the paint.
Lights out player. Like, it was like all or nothing.
That nobody was like that ever. Maybe Larry Bird. Maybe Larry Bird. I'll give him that. He was like, win, win, win. Like, I'm going to die or win. But Jordan was extensive and forever.
Right.
Like that.
Well, you got to – I wore a shirt of somebody you need to paint, Magic Johnson. You need to do a Magic, man.
Magic is – he's my top five of all time.
Me too. I want to pull up one last painting because we're running out of time. Okay. I want to pull up the Kobe Bryant, the Black Mamba. This is a tremendous painting. And you know what? I was staring at it today, and I was like, it's so cool that you put the Black Mamba on his wrist. Like, that was such a cool, cool, cool move. You have the coloring. You have him just flying through the air over the Staples Center. Tell me, like, what was behind this?
I mean, you know, it's funny. I did three paintings of Kobe. I did that one. I did the one without Black Mamba. And I did the one with, a small afro. Kobe, like Jordan, represents excellence.
Yes.
He was excellent. He was excellent at what he did. He was an extraordinary basketball player. He was emblematic of Los Angeles. You know, he's flying in the clouds above the Staples Center. And it was like a classic, just a classic side of Kobe.
Right.
You know, where it's like he was just in his zone, in his moment. There's an ethereal calmness about him sometimes.
Yes.
You know, where he had a killer instinct like Jordan, but it wasn't the same every play I'm going to die for it.
Right. Right.
Because in a lot of ways, you know, he was maybe a little bit more talented. Like, he couldn't jump as high, but his, like, I just feel like he had, because he started so much younger and he got into the league so much younger and his dad was a ball player. And then he's just got a weird, worldly, calm, beautiful energy. And I wanted to showcase that. And once again, that comes back to, like, my portraits. It's like, I want to showcase the spirit of the artist, whether they're a basketball player, a jazz musician, you know, or a hip hop artist or whatever.
Well, you did it. And I love the expression on his face. Justin Bua, we're running out of time, but I just want to say, what an honor and pleasure it was to interview you tonight.
Thank you, brother.
And I hope that, you know, whatever future works, we'd love to have you back and, you know, showcase those works as well. You're a tremendous artist. You're a tremendous painter. And I know everybody can find you at Justin Bua on Instagram or justinbua.com for all of your work. But thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. I really appreciate it. This has been a fascinating conversation that I will never forget for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I appreciate that, man. Really, it was a great opportunity for me. Thank you.
Well, awesome. On behalf of Justin, myself, and Sam, we'll see you guys next week. Peace and love. And take care.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.